Okay, well, we were in 1 Samuel 18 last week, so I reckon let's move on to 1 Samuel 19. We'll read it here in a moment, but just as a recap, we tried to trace a theme through the chapter last week, and I think we saw Saul's jealousy and David's response would be a good way to capture what's going on. And among it, right, Saul's continued decline over against David's rise. We saw that in several ways, right? We saw Saul becoming increasingly jealous of David, so that his madness, whatever this mental disturbance is, continued to affect him even more. He directed that at David, right, with throwing a spear at him, but in a way that there's potential for David to not necessarily take that personally. Right? I reckon from David's perspective, the antagonism is a little ambiguous. Within chapter 18, we'll see if that continues in chapter 19. Right? Because in the midst of that, Saul is doing that in moments of where his madness is manifesting itself. But he's also offering his daughter to David in marriage. And of course, David passes on his firstborn daughter, but then marries Michal. And so David continues to rise in prominence, which makes Saul more and more insecure. And then we get to chapter 19. So we'll ask ourselves some of the same questions as we read it. Is there a theme that hangs over it? Does it divide up into smaller chunks? What connections might it have to other chapters? But instead of reading on our own like we did last time, why don't I read it out loud to us and just make notes of things you might see as we do so. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the fields where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I will tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. And there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow, so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed, that I may kill him." And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed, and the pillow of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go, so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" Now David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naioth. And it was told Saul, "Behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah." Then David sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah, and came to the great well that is in Sekou. And he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah." And he went there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? So, what things do you notice? We'll start maybe with divisions. Could we divide this chapter into separate episodes or scenes? Okay, so maybe a whole episode surrounding David and Jonathan and Saul that maybe we could split it up into smaller bits, but where would we draw the lines there?
In the post-fighting world,
Okay, so how far does the bit with Saul and David and Jonathan go? From verse 1 to... Okay. Verses 1 through 7. Jonathan's kind of the linking figure there. And then from 8 on, so they come back from fighting the Philistines, and how far does it go? Yeah, so we could go from 8 to 10, but it seems closely linked to what follows, which goes from 11 to where? Yeah, I think we can split it at 17. Here we talk about in Saul's house and Saul's daughter. Okay. And then from 18, how far do we go? Yeah, to the end, right? So verse 24. Maybe just a shorthand, Samuel's the uniting figure there. So we're in 1 Samuel 19. We've just read through the chapter together, trying to find places it divides up. What theme? Right, is there a theme that hangs over these verses, maybe? Something that maybe takes each of these episodes and brings them together? That's true, yeah.
I mean, it's certainly about him.
Yeah.
They also all pursued him, but...
Maybe that's a good way of describing the chapter, Saul's pursuit. David's there, but Saul seems to be more of a main character. Okay. What sorts of connections could we draw with earlier passages we've read or other parts of Scripture? Got to make us some room over here. So Jonathan's loyalty. Not just Jonathan's, though. Right? Michael shows loyalty to David as well. She stops short of showing the same kind of loyalty that Jonathan does. Right? Jonathan boldly stands up for David to his father. And Michael, with her actions, lets David escape. But she stops short of, as it were, speaking well of or speaking in David's defense. Right? As though she still fears her father. I mean, quite reasonable for her to do so, right? He's going mad before the people of Israel. He's moody. He's violent. He's out for blood. So that wouldn't be too hard on Michael in that scenario. This picks up what we saw already in the previous chapter, right? Both of those things connect back to 18. Where Jonathan and Michael both love David and show their love for David, which is continuing this idea of kind of closing the door on a dynasty for Saul. Yeah. And he'll say that explicitly later, which offers some explanation for his behavior here. Because true, David could turn around and just end things, right? He could yank that spear out of the wall and just have done with his enemy. So, but David doesn't. Yeah. So David's non-aggression, maybe we could call it, in response. He flees rather than sets himself against God's anointed. Good. We do still have that harmful spirit. As we talked about last time, how the spirit doesn't, that harmful spirit from the Lord doesn't introduce something new into Saul's heart, but stirs up the kinds of sins, agitates Saul along lines he's already bent, with the fear of losing power, the jealousy of rivals.
So it would seem too from this that it comes and goes. It's not something that's there. Because it didn't say the spirit returned or remained. It says it's like it came again or another or however.
So yeah. So, yeah, as an observer, which makes it all the more terrifying for the people around him, that this harmful spirit comes and goes. So from an observer standpoint, right, Saul is going through these terrible, awful mood swings. Good. Yeah. It's not a harmful spirit that takes up residence. One who comes and stays for afternoon tea or for a long weekend. Or How do you feel about time? We've observed with some of the earlier chapters that reading it through sequentially feel disoriented. You're not sure where we are, right? Does David and Goliath happen before or after David has entered into Saul's service, right? There seems to be, Saul clearly knows who he is in chapter 16, and then he has no idea who he is in chapter 17. And chapter 18 kind of left us in that this happened, and this happened, and this happened, but it's not clear that it's this happened, then this happened, then this happened. I feel, observing as we read chapter 19, that we're kind of entering back into a normal sequence of time. I don't know if you get that same feeling reading chapter 19. Maybe you don't. But I do think that's a very interesting and very deliberate thing the narrator does for three or four chapters. In three or four chapters that are characterized by Saul slowly losing his grip on everything. Everything. Power, family, reality, his own sanity. To be kind of jostled around in that way. But my sense is that here we're kind of resuming normal time and then tracing out the narrative. Like an accordion, right? Some moments of time are very compressed, and then other moments of time are drawn out in sort of slow motion. So, I find it very interesting that we're used to that sort of thing in the things we read and the things that we watch, but then when we come to Scripture, we're surprised and disoriented by them. So. Yeah, verse 8. Like, is this a seasonal campaign, or is this a couple of battles, or is this drawn out over multiple years? Don't know. I think that gives us more trouble than it would have given us if we were reading this a couple hundred years ago. Because I think following the 20th century, we have a tendency to think about a war as in long protracted wars that have names, right? Like capital letter names. As opposed to like the difference between battle and war is battle is an engagement and war is like a string of battles around the same offensive or defensive measure. But that still leaves us wondering, okay, verse 8, is that a couple months or a couple years? That Samuel? Yeah. Yeah, Samuel's been completely off the table for quite a while. I don't remember. I think the last time we saw him was when he anointed David back in chapter 16. So he's not present in chapter 17, which is very interesting, right? Because Samuel previously went with the people when they went to war. But he's not there in chapter 17. And Saul, whom you would expect would kind of fulfill the role of leader, of course, was cowering in his tent like everyone else. But yeah, now he's back, and it's not good news for Saul. Rose.
Also, Saul doesn't say Saul goes on the Philistine.
This is true. Yeah, you know, when you look at verse 8 there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so David is the one going in and out with the armies. Saul doesn't seem to be doing so anymore. Which, if you want to speak well of Saul, you look at his earlier reign, that's one of the few things that he seems to have done well. Right? He commands respect because of his size, right? He's huge, right? He's head and shoulders above everybody else. He sends a threat that rallies the people, and he's able to deliver a city, right? So one thing you can say in Saul's favor is that he seems to be able to achieve military success, and he's not even doing that anymore. Which, as Rose is pointing out, as we get several chapters down the road, when David doesn't go out with the army, that's That's not good news. Although the narrator brings it up rather more explicitly there, right? In the spring of the year when kings go out to war, King David didn't. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe Saul's protecting himself, right? But he doesn't appear on the battlefield where David, you know, outperforms him, then maybe people are less apt to make that comparison. Oh, yeah. This is quite true. When Saul, as a military commander, goes in pursuit of David and then can't find him or can't get him or is gotten by him, as it were, twice. So. Good. I love how, if we look at the individual pieces, what happens in verses 1 through 7 that really pushes the overall narrative forward? Right? If this is a season 3 of 1 Samuel, right? Season 1 is Samuel and his rise. Season 2 is the kingship and Saul. And if now we're in season 3, Saul's demise and David's rise, what happens in these first 7 verses that pushes that narrative forward? So we do. We have Saul's own son promoting David to Saul, speaking over against his father. Now, we had pieces of that already in chapter 18. So what's new about that conversation or that bit of things here? David's now expressly aware, right? And Jonathan is aware, right? Not just that Saul is jealous, but Saul wants to kill David. And Jonathan demonstrates clearly in his actions a loyalty to David over against concern for himself. Never mind his right to the throne, even his own personal safety. Right? He puts himself squarely on David's side, over against his father, not just on David's side as a friend whom he loves, but on David's side over against his father, and in doing so makes David expressly aware, my father's out to kill you. And so we see David, in the next section, has a rather different reaction to Saul hurling the spear. Right? He doesn't just get away, right, and manage to not get pinned. What does he do? Right? Saul's changed his mind. He's promised him safety. He says, of course, he won't be put to death. And then when this madness comes over again, he tries to pin David to the wall with the spear. This time, David's not like, okay, you know, once the music starts playing again, he'll be fine, right? He runs away. Yeah. It's like, okay, I'm going to run home and pack my bags. So, and then we have a similar piece with Saul's daughter Michal, then. She doesn't just love David. She sides with David. Right? Yeah. Why does David go back home? Because, of course, Saul's going to look for him there. I don't know. He doesn't seem to stay very long. Yeah. So. Maybe he's kissing his wife goodbye. I don't know. Yeah. He goes home. He gets some things. He leaves. Right? But because he goes home and it's known or expected that he would go home, and he manages to either leave before they get there or kind of sneak out, it does give him time to get away. But yeah. David seems to be a good strategist. So why does he do? Yeah, why does he do what they would expect him to do? I don't know. And then here's an important piece that I think we need to not miss in the chapter. Where does David go from there? He goes to Samuel. We haven't heard a lot from Samuel lately. But what is Samuel's significance in the story up to this point? Or if we go back to the analogy of watching a long-term series, right? This is kind of reaching a moment in season 3 where we reach back to a character we haven't seen for a little while. But why Samuel? Why Samuel? Why not back home? Right? He's the youngest of 8 brothers. I reckon his brothers are on his side. His brothers have been in Saul's service. So they are men of war who are battle-hardened, right? And there's certainly wilderness in the area if he's been fighting lions and bears. So why doesn't he go home? Why does he go to Samuel? Yeah, Samuel is the prophet. Yeah, so there's asylum, there's mentoring, there's inquiring of God, all of that, which is one other way that contrasts David and Saul. When things go wrong, what does Saul do? He grasps at power, right? When things go wrong, what does David do? He goes to the man of God. And then how do things go? Right? Saul figures out where he is. He goes in pursuit. And what happens? Yeah. He gets thwarted. He gets thwarted in a very interesting way. I don't know if this is the norm for prophets prophesying or not, right? But Saul ends up there, and he ends up laying there naked and prophesying. And presumably David gets away, goes off somewhere else. So it's interesting. I think we tend to not notice this, but there are people there with Samuel. He's presiding over a school of prophets, you might say. So Saul just seems to fall in among his pupils and do what they're doing. Whatever that is, it's definitely weird. It's definitely weird. We didn't do that in seminary. Yeah, it's not at RTS anyway. Yeah. Now, is this the first time that this proverb has come up? Is Saul also among the prophets? Is this the first time that Saul has prophesied? No, like this same phenomenon has come up earlier. Back when Saul was looking for the donkeys, right? What do you reckon the significance of that is? Let me find the passage. Yeah. It's in chapter 10. chapter 10, verses 9 and following. So I'll read that bit for us. When he turned his back to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart. And all these signs came to pass that day. When they came to Gibeah, behold, a group of prophets met him. And the Spirit of God rushed upon him, and he prophesied among them. And when all who knew him previously saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man of the place answered, "And who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" When he had finished prophesying, he came to the high place. So that's in 10, verses 9 through 13. And then we had it again here in 19, say like 23 and 24. So the first one occurs right after he talks to Samuel. The second time occurs when he's looking for Samuel and doesn't find him. Well, Samuel's there, actually. Samuel's there in verse 23, or 24. What do we make of that? So these two passages are connected by the proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" They're connected by Samuel and his interaction with Saul. They're connected by this act of prophesying. And they're connected by a work of the Spirit. In a sense, they're connected with momentous transitions, right? Saul having just been anointed king and rising to that position in the first instance. And Saul clearly being confirmed as losing the kingship in ways that have already been promised. Right? Because in this first instance, right, he's found the donkeys, or he's about to find the donkeys. And in that moment has also found the kingship. And here, he's going in search of David. And in that moment, that turning is in a very real sense turning away from his responsibilities and role as king to chase this perceived rival. We'll see that play out in later chapters, this tension between, right, he still has to act as a king, and will he? Or will he kind of sacrifice all it means for him to be king in relentlessly pursuing David? Right? We'll have moments where he has to turn back from chasing David because of enemies who are attacking Israel. And we may think in that moment, he's still acting something like a king. But remember, the reason he has to turn back is because he's left Israel unprotected by pursuing David in those moments. I think it's really interesting that we get this kind of double comment on this proverb associated with Paul, Saul, and where it comes from and its origin. And I don't think we have two opposing explanations, right? As though we know this proverb is associated with Saul, and one group says this is why, and another group says this is why. I think actually if we look at all these other ways that they're connected, Right? The proverb seems to bookend Saul's kingship. And so appropriately, and of course we could give a positive answer or a sarcastic answer, right? And I think because of where we leave Saul here, the proverb takes a sarcastic tone, right? At the beginning of his reign, is Saul also among the prophets, right? That question seems filled with hope. And at the end of his reign here, although his reign will take quite a while to completely fall apart, already here, I think it's lost any hopeful tone. Is Saul also among the prophets? No. No. Yes. And there's another sense in which that question takes on a different tone. Here, at the beginning of his reign, I think that prophecy that we're asking about is associated with hope, right? And here, it's associated with all the weirdness. All the weirdness and all of the randomness. And so, at the beginning, that proverb and the question it asks is perhaps asking about Saul's rise, right? Is he the one we're looking for? Is he the one who's been promised in prophecy? And here at the end, is Saul also among the prophets? Well, maybe we're asking that because his behavior is erratic. And he does weird things. And he has these spiritual mood swings, right? Which reminds us of the ways that the prophets are weird. So, it takes on a bit of a bite there at the end. Well, they certainly do some weird things, right? We don't seem to see Samuel doing those weird things, but we do have Samuel presiding over students doing weird things. So, yeah. Yeah. So. All right. Well, this wraps us up just about on time. So we'll move into chapter 20 next week.
Did you think there was more going on there with the mechanism, considering the people around that probably had a certain amount of sexual activity in the temples? Did you incorporate in that?
I don't know. I think that's a fair question. Throughout the ancient world. Well, Samuel's presiding over things. So, I think that gives me hesitation. But yeah, certainly in the surrounding area, you had a great number of fertility cults, right? Baal was essentially a fertility god, right? So, and when you worship a fertility god, right, certain things go along with that. Yeah. And whether that is, I don't think that that's necessarily what's going on here with the school of prophets that Samuel's presiding over. Although I wouldn't doubt that some of the people may have wondered if such a thing were going on. So. Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I wondered if anybody was going to ask about that as we went through it, right? Why does there seem to be an idol, right? A stone idol just available in David's house? For Michael to hide in the bed? That's a good question. One of the things that happens, I think, in conversations between the church and archaeology is, right, archaeologists will dig things up in the ancient Near East and they'll say, look, the Israelites were polytheists. They worshipped all these other gods, right? The Bible's not true. And I want to say, have you read the Old Testament? Because that's what the Old Testament tells us about them. We would expect that. It was wrong for them to do so, but they did it all the time. So, yeah.
Well, it's kind of like the oldest story of the ark. Well, it predates the Jewish history. Well, it doesn't. But it substantiates it just because they're like the written, and theirs is oral, doesn't mean that the written
All right. Well, we'll jump into chapter 20 next week. So, thank you.